Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Apúrate que se acaban las ofertas de Early Black Friday en Lowe's. Ahorra hasta 50% en electrodomésticos selectos y hasta 25% extra en combos de electrodomésticos selectos. Y como la Navidad ya se siente, ahorra $4 en luces LED de 100 bombillas en hilera GE. Ahora a solo $5.98. Lowe's, nosotros ayudamos. Tú ahorras. Válido hasta 12/3. Selección varía por tienda. Solo en tiendas selectas hasta agotar existencias. Detalles en Lowe's.com.
On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Maria, and Maria was married to an emotional and financial abuser. It's a story of mirroring, long-distance relationships, the fog, boundary testing, infidelity, built-in excuses, and divorce. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. I am Brandon Chadwick, and with me today, we have Maria. How are you?
I'm doing well, Brandon. Thanks.
Well, thank you for being here. And if you want to be a guest like Maria is today, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com and click on the guest form button at the top of the page. There you can read all of our instructions, and please read them all and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form and press the submit button. And please do send it in the format that we ask for. And we do not have a content warning for this episode. And today you're going to hear Maria's story. And Maria was married to an emotional abuser who was also a financial abuser. And there were lots of logical explanations in Maria's story as to why the relationship continued, made lots of promises, but also mental health became a big issue as well as past trauma. You know, people will feel very validated by Maria's story today. So a big thank you to Maria for being here once again. And now I'm going to get out of my way and your way. Maria, the floor is now yours.
Thanks, Brandon. So I'll start by talking about kind of where I come from, my family background, because it definitely informs my choice to get into this relationship. That is a subject of what we're talking about today. So I'm the oldest of three kids, and my father died in a car accident unexpectedly, obviously, when I was 11 years old. And that effectively ended my childhood. After that, I had adult level responsibilities. I didn't get to enjoy the rest of my childhood. I had to help my mother with household management, prepare meals, take care of my siblings. When I got my license, I had to pick them up from school, take them to school, take them around. So I watched my friends, engage in appropriate activities for their ages, you know, go out, do stuff, eventually drive around, have parties, start to date. And none of that was on my radar. I was consumed by these adult level responsibilities. And that set me up for a lot of codependency. Like, I had to be in charge. I had to help, right? This compulsion to self-sacrifice, things like that. So that was difficult. Now, my mother, my relationship with her has always been very tense. She had a very a terrible childhood. She grew up in Eastern Europe during a Soviet occupation, and her family fled during the 1956 Hungarian Revolution. So she witnessed as a young child war situations, and they moved around a lot before ending up in the US. So she had a terrible childhood. Her parents were physically abusive. Her mother was most likely a narcissist. So yeah, I have a lot of empathy for my mother. I want to preface what I say with that. I think she did the best she could, but she likely has qualifies for a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. She was emotionally unavailable, certainly was after my father died. She just did not provide the emotional comfort that my siblings and I needed. It was very much a, well, here's what we have to do. You know, don't be dramatic, just get stuff done. So I did not have the emotional support and comfort that I needed as a kid or as a teenager. Yeah, so she was emotionally unavailable, and she could not handle any emotion that was not neutral agreeableness. If you showed an intense negative emotion, sadness or something like that, she got angry, or she would just be completely dismissive. She would be angry at you, the child, for expressing the emotion. So that, of course, leads to a whole host of issues like emotional repression and other things. But likewise, if you were very happy, expressed joy or exuberance, she would say or do something to cut that down, to give you a reason not to be happy, not to be satisfied. So I never knew. It was constantly like shifting goalposts. I never knew how to please my mother. I never knew what was expected of me. She was also jealous of me. She wanted me to achieve, to make her look good, but not too much. One example from my adulthood, she stole a job from me. One day I shared with her that I found this job I was interested in. I was going to apply. And her response was, I wonder if that would be something I would be interested in. She applied for the job and got the job. I mean, now when I think about that, that's crazy. So things like this. So it was very difficult growing up. It was a constant shift and a constant, this push-pull dynamic. She would either be enmeshed and intrusive or completely dismissive of your emotions. One time I complained about how I was bullied at school. And I'll never forget this. She was drinking a glass of water and she said, just ignore them, without even looking at me, and walked away. Another time I complained about bullying and she got angry with me and said, well, those bullies are jealous of your good grades. And she got angry with me, but there was no validation. There was no, well, I'm really sorry that happened to you. Nothing. There was none of that. So it was very confusing. I experienced a ton of confusion in my childhood because I never knew which version of my mother I was going to get. And that confusion carried over into the relationship we're going to talk about. That's why I think on some level it felt familiar or even comforting to me, because that it mimicked what I received in my childhood. My mother lauded me for getting good grades, but also called me antisocial and made fun of the fact that I had few friends. She told me I was too skinny. I gained weight, but I was too fat. I needed to lose weight. There was no middle ground. There was no acceptance. There was no, I mean, I remember, like I tell people now, I have a teenager myself now. And I tell parents now, when I was my son's age, I would get up at 8 every day, not just for school. I would get a healthy breakfast. I worked out because working out made me feel good, all on my own. And there was no validation. There was no, hey, it's great that you're doing all this on your own. You're so self-motivated. There was none of that, right? There was criticism. My mother has always been very critical. She criticized how I walked. One time she criticized how I drank water. I mean, it was crazy. It was extreme criticism, just very critical. So I grew up with that and those feelings of never being good enough, right? And it drove me to achieve in my adulthood, you know, just for it to be accepted, right? That love was conditional, acceptance was conditional, affection was conditional, relationships were conditional. I had to do stuff and be of service to get, you know, affection, attention from the other person in the relationship. So, yeah.
And when it comes to your views on the world, your views on relationships, you know, how are you seeing everything? And did you have something you wanted to be when you grew up? Like, what was your like idea of who you were and where you were going to go?
Right. So it took me a while to figure out what I wanted to kind of do when I grew up to, with my life as far as career and things like that. It took me a long time to figure out actually what I wanted as opposed to what I should do or what society dictated I do, right? That's a different story. But right. So I wanted to be on my own. I wanted to be independent. I'm an introvert. I grew up in a household of extroverts, and you know, my siblings were younger at the time, but my mother never even attempted to understand that I needed alone time, I needed downtime, I needed time to kind of decompress from the day, that was how I recharged my energy. She never bothered to even try to understand that. So I wanted to get out of my mother's house, go to college, and eventually live on my own, which I did. Also, though, I saw relationships as burdensome and requiring self-sacrifice and restricting one's freedom, and to some extent I still think of it that way, because I mean, they do, they compel you to compromise on some level, but I saw them as restricting my freedom, being burdensome, right? And I also have very little patience for people who continuously see themselves as a victim, like blaming everybody else for what happens to them. I have very little patience. I'm a pick yourself up by the bootstraps person. I've always been that way. Not everybody agrees with that, but that's always, since childhood, that's how I've been. Just do what needs to be done. You know, that's it. You just deal with stuff as it comes, right? And it's good to be resilient like that, but it took me a long time to be able to ask for help with anything, with relationships, with household stress, with mental health. It took me a long time to be in a place where I could actually ask for help. That was always very difficult. I was always, have always been that rugged individualist. I will just do this on my own. Yeah, that's how I was used to doing it. So yeah, but definitely I thought I had a healthy dose of detachment and skepticism regarding relationships, which is why it's so crazy to me that I found myself in this situation, this relationship we're going to talk about.
So what is going on in your life right before you meet this person? And then tell us, the story of meeting this person, what happens from there?
Sure. So in 2003, I married my first husband, not the subject of what we're going to talk about, but my first husband, we met at work, married him. We had a child together. It's my one child that I have. It was not a good match. There were some parallels between that relationship and my relationship with my mother that I can identify now, but it was just not a good match. So we were together for about 10 years before I decided to end that relationship. So I had just ended my first marriage. In fact, we were not officially divorced yet because it took about a year for that divorce to go through in my state. But in the months following my separation and my first husband moving out of the house, I met John. And we met online in a special interest Facebook group. And we were friends at first, and we were friends. I can see now, with benefit of hindsight, how he targeted me. He's probably targeting multiple women at the same time, but he probably targeted me. So he was out of state. He lived in Texas at the time, and we struck up a friendship, communicated, and then one day he asked for my number. Now, and he made it clear that he was interested, like romantically interested. Now, I liked the fact that he took initiative to do that, because my experience at the time was that a lot of men were had a lot of anxiety about approaching women and risking rejection. So I actually liked the fact that he took initiative to risk rejection. To me, that spoke highly of him. To me, that reflected well on him. Now, I will point out that he's a lot younger than me. He's 15 years younger than me. So I was 39 almost 40 at the time, and he was 25. And I liked that too, because I'm a person who has a lot of energy and I do a lot of stuff. And most people my age, I find are just not as active as I am, right? So I don't always mesh well with them. So I like that. So we met at the time. I didn't think anything of it. I was not looking for a long-term relationship. I was just kind of open to the idea and having fun. So that's how we met. And then we started communicating, first texting and then talk on the phone. And of course, because we met in this special interest group, we had that in common. So I like the fact that we had that in common. We talked a lot about that special interest and kind of grew from there. Now, we bonded very quickly, as usually happens in these toxic relationships, right? We had a similar trauma in our childhood. I lost my father very young. His mother walked out of the house when he was around 7 or 8 years old. So he had a very fraught relationship with his mother. Clearly we had that in common. So I thought, you know, there's some understanding here, things like that. We came from different backgrounds, different generations, obviously, but we did have or appear to have a lot of common ground at the time. Now, I will say, now that I could do the postmortem of this relationship in a detached way, that we had a lot less in common than I thought. What happened was he mirrored back to me what he thought I would be interested in. He mirrored back to me my personality traits, my values. I had, for example, I talked about I was saving money to retire early to be able to travel and write and not have a 9-to-5 job. He said that was an interest of his too. He wanted to travel and do all these things, right? So clearly I should have focused more on his behavior than his words. But he mirrored a lot to me in the beginning. There was a lot of future faking. Here's all the stuff we're going to do. Here's all the stuff we're going to achieve, right? All those things. So, but he hooked me very quickly. Unfortunately, I committed to that relationship too quickly. So what happened was we talked for 2 or 3 months. He flew up here. I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. He flew up here to visit me. And then from then on, we were in a committed relationship. So he was able to hook me quickly from the beginning. And the way he did that was through a lot of love bombing. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this. A lot of saying the right things. A lot of you're so beautiful. A lot of you're the only person who understands me, right? All the things that narcissists do to hook you in the beginning. So that's how it started.
With all of those things happening and you're getting hooked here, do you feel at that moment that you're yourself?
Oh, good question. I thought so. I think one of the reasons that we were together for so long, that I allowed this to continue for so long, was that throughout much of our relationship, we were long distance. So that even if it felt intense and I felt like not myself, we would have these periods where we were apart and I would be more detached. And so he would come visit me or I would go visit him. And our time together was very intense. There's a lot of physical activity, right? Physical intimacy. And I felt almost like under a spell, right? But I attributed that to the long distance nature of the relationship to, well, we don't see each other that often. So if we're only seeing each other 1 week every 2 months, of course, it's going to be intense. It's a new relationship. I attributed it to that. So yeah, that was a big mistake on my part, but yes.
Because when you're in a long distance relationship and the time that you're spending together, you try to maximize every second in this, like it's no wasted time. Everyone is fully paying attention. Phones are down.
Yes.
You know, and within a long distance relationship, when you're out of it, when you've gone back home to where you're from, or, you know, they leave, that your life goes back to normal. You might be texting, and it's easy for an abuser to just text like heart, you know, oh, they care. But like the intensity of that is of whatever they're doing is gone, and you don't know what they're doing over there, but you yourself are going back to your life and are the things that you're doing every day. So it's like its own mini version of a push-pull that is acceptable and feels normal in a way.
Yes. And there were times that I felt relieved when he left because I could breathe again, just for the reasons you just stated, Brandon. And again, I attributed that to, well, this is intense because it's a, you know, long distance relationship. We're maximizing the time together, all making the most of it, like you said. But there were, and I should have paid more attention to that. I should have paid more attention as to why I was more relaxed. Now, he would try to, you know, he would call me, we would FaceTime together, things like that. And sometimes that would get a little bit too much. One other thing I noticed was that he would get really emotional. He exhibited emotional dysregulation, you know, get angry, not necessarily at me, but about something going on with his life. And he would want to talk a lot on the phone, or sometimes talk late at night, or make me feel guilty, say things to make me feel guilty for not wanting to talk to him late at night when I had work the next day. And that's a foreshadowing right there, because in the death throes of this relationship, he engaged in chronic sleep deprivation. It was terrible. But that was a precursor to that, yeah.
Yeah, and here he's not listening to your boundaries. He's stretching your boundaries. And he is a time thief. He is stealing your time, and he's stealing your energy, and he's not paying attention to that. And again, long distance relationship, you know, maybe these are the things that you kind of have to do to stay connected.
Right. Exactly. And I thought, well, I've always been a little bit avoidant myself. So if it's that could be my issue. Right. I'm not saying I don't have issues or didn't have issues to work on. I did. But right, exactly. And that boundary testing, there was a lot of that seemingly innocuous boundary testing in the beginning. Me, for example, texting, hey, good night, and him texting, oh, I just got back to the house. I was going to ask you if you wanted to FaceTime. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe I can for a couple minutes. Again, with the boundary pushing. So one time, this is another example, a different example of a boundary violation. I didn't recognize it at the time as such. I was visiting him. We were at his parents' house, and he told me to come into this room with him. I thought he was going to show me something there. And he lifted up the back of my shirt and adjusted my bra for me. That's it, adjusted my bra. I did not ask him to do that. I did not voice any discomfort. He adjusted my bra and said, okay, now it's more comfortable for you. Well, he lifted up my shirt without even telling me what he was going to do to adjust my bra. Nothing, that was it. But it was a boundary violation. It was an unconsented to touching. It was, hey, are your clothes uncomfortable? No, I will decide if my clothes are uncomfortable. You don't need to adjust my clothes for me. Things happen like that. And I, again, just one seemingly small example like that, I didn't really pay attention to. But now looking back, he was very much testing my boundaries throughout the relationship. It was very much a frog in slowly boiling water situation. And once you're in it and you realize what's happening, now you're in deep. And now it's even harder to get out of it. Yeah. So what happens from here? So we were long distance until about for about a year and a half. And then he moved up here to move in with me. And we were already talking about getting married. And he said, oh, we'll have to save up for your ring and things like that. Fine. So he got a job. Well, a lot of stuff happened. I'll try to parse it out. The one thing was he got a job and then quickly got fired from that. And that started a whole process of him being chronically unemployed or underemployed, right? Well, I have a job, but it didn't last, right? So he never really contributed financially in a meaningful way. And that's one thing. The other thing that happened was, now my son at the time was about 7 years old, and he started kind of parenting and disciplining my son right away, not physically, because I never would have accepted that, but telling him what to do or talking over me when I was instructing my son. And I said, I don't like this. My son has two parents in his life. His father and I still have joint custody. And you're a step parent. You are new to this dynamic. You have to build a relationship with him, show him you're a safe person, all these things. I don't accept you to just come in and start parenting him. For example, my son would ask me a question, and before I could answer, John would answer, right? And then I would say, no, what I was going to say is this. And then John would say, you're undermining me. And I said, you are taking over my parenting. This is unacceptable. Right. Now, I didn't like that. And then after he lost the first job he had, he sat at home for a month and pretty much did nothing. Now, this was my first attempt to leave, right? A couple months, maybe a handful of months after he moved in. I told him, I don't like how you are parenting my son. It's too much too soon. And I don't like the fact that you're sitting at home unemployed. You had a job and now, you know, you just sit at home and you're not contributing. And I told him to leave. And of course, that the big time manipulation started. He started to cry. He started to throw up. He said, please, please, I didn't need any of that. One time he told my son, children should be seen and not heard. And I told him during that conversation, I don't agree with that. How you parent is not acceptable to me. How it's not compatible. And he said, well, I didn't mean that. I meant that listening is more important than speaking. He always knew the right thing to say. I mean, he's a very intelligent person. He always knew how to twist words around. Well, that's not what I meant. Well, I did this, but it really, you saw this, but it was really this. Well, I really meant this. So that attempt to leave obviously did not work. Now there's more to this particular story about this first attempt to leave. When I had voiced some concerns to my mother, she kind of tried to take over the situation. And I had family members basically telling me what to do and bothering me and texting me all the time, like, what are you going to kick him out? What are you going to kick him out? And I was trying to gather my thoughts, gather a plan, figure out what to do. I had John manipulating me and I had family members texting me constantly, not leaving me alone. And I basically was in a complete fog, right? That's an important point to make, I think, is that when the family members are telling the victim what to do, they're doing the same as the abuser. It doesn't help. Like, you need to back off and offer support. Like, I'm sorry you're going through this. What can I do? If you choose to leave, let me know and how I can help. I will do whatever I can to help you. But they jumped in and told me what to do, right? And then when I didn't do what they told me what to do, they withdrew support. Then you leave the victim alone, even more alone. So I want to point that out to any victims who may be going through a similar dynamic. So long story short, that attempt to leave did not work because John, of course, you know, manipulated me and turned on the waterworks and played the victim card and told me he would change and do all these things. So anyway, so we stayed together. I insisted he come to family therapy with me. And of course, in family therapy, he said all the right things. The therapist told him, you need to let Maria parent and you need to support her. You don't parent in her stead, right? So, you know, he this is a pattern with him. He would agree to the compromise. He would agree. And then he would do whatever he wanted. He wouldn't care. There was no consideration for me. He didn't care. He would just do whatever he wanted. So, it's interesting that I think about this because later that year, 2017, he was working in the oil field when he and I met in Texas. He got another job in the oil field later that year, a few months later, and then that took him away out of state for several weeks each month. So I saw him less. It's very interesting, right? So that he put some distance between us. And that was also a pattern I noticed when he intuited that I was about to snap and kick him out, he would give me space. He would like just give me the space and harp on me less. So looking back on it, I can see that pattern clearly now. So yeah, so he got another job in the oil field, was working, was maybe home 1 week in a month at most. And that again gave me the space, right? Oh, this is more comfortable. Now I have more space. I can have the relationship I want with my son without interference, all these things. And he would send money home because he was working. So that happened. And then through 2018, end of 2018, he got an on the job injury. He was injured working on an oil rig and he did not return to the oil field. He stayed in Texas for a while. He was working with his father September 2018, he saved up enough money for an engagement ring and proposed to me. I said yes, unfortunately. Now, I said yes, but I had a lot of anxiety because I had a lot of concerns based on everything we just said, and also his drinking. That's something I haven't mentioned yet. I was very naive about his drinking. He's an alcoholic, and he drank pretty much every day. And I noticed that, man, he drinks a lot. Like, I've not never been a huge drinker myself, and nobody in my family has substance abuse or alcohol abuse, so or alcohol addiction. So I was very naive about that. But I remember when he proposed, I thought about that, and I had misgivings. So I was in no rush to get married. In fact, he asked me about planning the wedding. I said, hey, there's no rush. So I put that off for a while. That was early 2019, he was still in Texas working with his father, thinking about looking for more oil field jobs, had a huge fight with his father, drove back up here where I live, moved in with me again, full time, 2019. Again, got a series of odd jobs, but none of them panned out. Now the pit out long-term, there was a huge gaslighting about his jobs. I want to point out, this is an area where he manipulated me a lot. So he would invariably start a new job and he didn't have any money. So I would buy him supplies for the new job. For example, I would buy him a uniform. He ended up bartending and working in the restaurant industry. I would buy him a restaurant uniform. And then he would start the job. And he may last a few weeks, months, whatever. And sometimes he would get fired after maybe a shift or two. And so he either would not work long enough to make any real money, or he would not give me any money from his paychecks. I would ask, and he would get angry with me. I would ask, hey, when's your first paycheck? We need that to help pay the bills, right? He would get angry with me. So not only was I paying for his work supplies, he was not using any money for household expenses. And then at the end of the year, when I got the tax bill, my taxes were higher because he had income on paper, right? But then he would tell me, why are you angry with me? I have a job. I said, yes, but it's a net negative for me. Is costing me money for you to work because you are spending your entire paycheck on going out or whatever, odds and ends. And I'm also buying you supplies for work and have a higher tax bill. And the last couple years of our relationship, which we'll get to, he had a suspended license for DUIs. And I was also paying for his Uber rides to and from work. And there were times I paid almost $1,000 a month in his Uber rides. So I'm paying for all this stuff. And it's a net negative for me. It was crazy. And he would tell me, I don't understand why you're kicking me out. I have a job. I said, yeah, but it's costing me money for you to have a job. And I thought, how is he not seeing this? But of course he saw that. That was part of the manipulation, right? So viewers may be, or listeners may be thinking, why would I stick it out? Well, he also has an ADHD diagnosis. And a lot of these things I'm describing, problems with unemployment, problems with, seeing things through, task completion, time blindness, money management, these are all correlated with ADHD. So a lot of his behavior I excused early on because it is correlated with ADHD. He had an ADHD diagnosis. He had medication. He took Adderall. He saw a therapist to treat the ADHD and prescribe the medication. So I excused a lot of that as well. He just needs some support with the ADHD. I sent him books. I sent him podcasts. I said, find an ADHD coach, all these things. But he always had an excuse for why he couldn't do things. For example, I said, I asked you to do this, these chores. You didn't do them. Well, you told me, but I can't remember. You have to text me a list. I would text him a list. Hey, why aren't these chores done? Well, you didn't text me in the right format. You texted a format that is confusing for me. Okay, I'm going to text you a list with bullet points. Here it is. Well, if you text me a list, I get other texts and it gets lost in the shuffle. You need to write the list for me on a piece of paper. I said, fine, here's a piece of paper with your chore list. Please get these done. He didn't do them. Why aren't they done? Well, you didn't put the chore list in a place where I could find it. And at the end of the relationship, we were in couples therapy because I insisted we go. And I when I relayed that story, I just relayed to you, to the couples therapist. And then I said, I don't know what else to do. And I literally yelled in couples therapy, I don't know what else to do. I need help. Right. So it wasn't that his ADHD prevented him from doing these things. It was that it was complete manipulation so he could continue to engage in inadequate behavior, just living like a single person on my dime. And in fact, in couples therapy, I said that. I asked him, why do you feel entitled to live off of my back? And of course, he didn't answer because, I mean, there's no acceptable way for him to answer, right? So anyway, that's just an aside. So in 2019, he was working off and on. And then, of course, then he retrained as a bartender. And he started working as a bartender. And then COVID happened, right? We were all home for like a year. But then he started bartending again after COVID. And that was that started a period of rapid decline in his behavior in our relationship. Because of course, bartending allowed him to drink and go out drinking with his buddies after his shift and spend all his money on going out. So he was very rarely home. Now that was a good thing because he wasn't home to bother us, but he was also not home to help, right?
And that whole lifestyle as a whole is going to present a lot of excuses of where I am and who I'm hanging out with. And now you're hanging out with, you know, people that have drinking problems and maybe drugs or who knows what can be involved here.
Right. Exactly. So he was never home. He'd be away sometimes 2 days, right? He would allegedly sleep at work, sleep on the sofa at work, or crash at buddies. He would say crash on a buddy's couch. I have no idea how much of this was true, how much wasn't true. I'm just, you know, I can only tell you what he told me, what I came to find out on my own. But yeah, it gave him the excuse to go out drinking. And when I would complain or question him, he would say, well, I go out after work to drum up business for the restaurant. That was a lie. He was going out to drinking, right? And he would also, for example, I may give him my credit card to use for groceries. I had to remember to get it back from him because if I didn't get my credit card back from him, he would use it to go out drinking. He would run my card. And there was a time over 2 months, he spent like almost $1,500 on my credit card at bars, right? And he said, I'll pay you back. And I said, okay, here's a credit card bill. I need the money. Well, I don't have it. Well, you said you'd pay me back, so I need the money. I don't have it. He would spend money as soon as he got it. I mean, he would even go to like, he would get his paycheck at like 9 at night. He would go to a check cashing place, pay the fees, get the money, go out drinking. I mean, he complained to his friends that he was always broke. Now, I will say there were times he made pretty good money as a bartender because we live in a pretty high-end area. There were times he made pretty good money. I didn't see any of it. Well, very little of it. But yeah, that's what he would do. And it was an excuse for him to go out drinking. And he would stand us up. I would make plans for like family dinners. We had plans one Easter. I said, we're having family Easter dinner at home. He said, I'll grill steaks. Great. He was off that day. It was a Sunday, right? Easter Sunday. Right. Then he gets a call from work. Oh, I have to go in to fix something with the lights. That was another thing. You know, we haven't talked too much about his mental illness, but he's, you know, in addition to ADHD, which is not a mental illness, neurological impairment, but he's got some cluster B personality disorder for sure. Probably something like borderline personality disorder. Definitely qualifies for narcissistic personality disorder, in my opinion. It's interesting that even though I'm describing this relationship that we had with him, he was so concerned with pleasing other people. Like he did a lot of extra work for free on at the restaurant where he worked to ingratiate himself with other people, right? It's interesting. So he got called into the restaurant to fix something with the lights. And then I said, well, come back because we're having dinner. Well, he never came back. He went out drinking with friends. Like that was pretty common to stand us up. In fact, he stood me up 3 weekends in a row and I just stopped making plans. One time we were home, a rare night where he didn't have a bartending shift, and we're watching a movie and he said, I'm going to go out and get us a bottle of wine. I said, okay, I'll be right here. 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock goes by. He doesn't come back. I'm texting him. Finally, he responds to my text. Oh, I ran into a friend of mine at the store. He invited me back to his place. And I said, I literally, you left me sitting here on the sofa like an idiot, like your fiance sitting here. Like what? I was not a priority to him at all. He didn't care. I was an NPC, a non-entity, like not even worthy of any consideration. That's how he treated us. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and with the bartending, of course, bartending, he was out drinking. Then I, you know, we definitely were having problems, obviously, because he was never home. Also not contributing meaningfully. And then in December 2020, I found out that he had gone on a date with some woman. I had checked his phone and he had gone on a date with some woman that he had met at the restaurant randomly. I don't know if anything physical happened. He says it didn't, but of course he's a pathological liar, so I can't trust him. But that was another attempt to leave that day. I said, well, this is ridiculous. Like, go, we're over, whatever. But of course, I reconsidered that. And I said, well, if you're serious about working on things, you have to do all these things and, you know, work on things, maybe go to therapy, whatever. And he said, yes, yes, I want to work on things. Well, no, he didn't want to work on the relationship. What he wanted, he didn't want to lose his gravy train, right? That's what that was about. So those months after I found that out, December 2020, were pretty dark. Like, I was suffering from betrayal trauma. I was in a complete fog, dissociated, like your brain's kind of offline. Like, you're not really, you're kind of aware, but not really aware. I was uber focused on pleasing him, right? Because of that. And of course, that played right into his hands, right? It was great for him. He probably thought, this is great. I could do whatever I want and she'll stick around.
So you said the words, you're uber focused on pleasing him. So there's this part of you that knows what is going on is wrong. And then there's this part of you that still wants to please him. So how are those two parts talking to each other? And who gets preference during the day? Like, which part gets to focus on more? Like the worrying part of you, or, okay, I'm just going to go do this and this and this and this and it's going to get better. Like, is there a dominant part during the day, or are you just like going back and forth? And are you talking to anyone else about these issues, and are they trying to help you through this at all?
At the time, no, I was talking to nobody about that. I was very ashamed. As far as your question about who is it, which was the dominant part, definitely when he was around in my presence, I was focused on pleasing him. When he was not around, I was more focused on myself and my relationship with my kid. I was prioritizing my relationship with my kid. But there was a lot of cognitive, I was experiencing a lot of cognitive dissonance because I knew what I had to do, but I couldn't do it. When he wasn't around, I had a lot more clarity. And I even would think about, well, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say this, and I'm going to tell him this, and I'm going to insist on this. But then when he was in my presence, it was like that all went out the window. It was like under a spell. I don't know how else to describe it other than that. Now, part of that was fear. I was afraid of him. He was emotionally volatile, emotionally dysregulated, could get angry. And when he drank, that was all worse. So he was drink a lot. So I was afraid. Like, part of me was, I was afraid to confront him. And I knew he would not accept, for example, that we had to go to therapy or that I wanted in the relationship. He would just try to manipulate me. And that sapped all of my energy. He engaged in a lot of chaos making. That's another reason why I couldn't get it together mentally to end the relationship earlier. Because, for example, he lost my car twice. So he was driving my car. His car was not roadworthy at the time for a fender bender or something. He was driving my car, my only car. he lost it twice. He came home and said, the car was stolen. It wasn't where I parked it. It was towed or stolen. I had to spend a lot of time figuring out where the car was. Turns out twice, it wasn't stolen or towed. He had reparked it probably. He had been drinking and didn't remember parking it somewhere else. And then it was just reparked and he didn't remember where he parked it. That happened twice, but that required me to go rent a car so I could drive to work and take my son to school. It required me to make police reports. He never lifted a finger for that. I had to do all that. I was so engaged in that and parenting and managing the household. There's no time. I tell people, it's like somebody is constantly throwing daggers at you and you are spending all your time and energy dodging the daggers and you don't have the time to sit and stop and think, who is throwing daggers at me and why? You just focused on surviving. That's what it was like. And that's why I did not end this earlier. So that went on, you know, and I'm sure listeners are familiar with his trauma cycle, this cycle of abuse. After an episode, the abuser is on best behavior for a while, right? They're on best behavior for a while. And then the victim thinks, well, you think, well, they're not that bad, or well, now they're this, or they're essentially trying to comfort you from the effects of the abuse they inflicted on you. It's very insidious, but when you're in it, it's hard to recognize that. So that was kind of a dark few months, early 2021. So in September 2021, we went to Spain to my cousin's wedding, had a great time, came back talking about retiring there, which was always an option that I had been thinking about, retiring from there. He had the idea to get married that December 2021. And we did. We got married, unfortunately, but we did. So, now it was a wedding that he, you know, threw together. It was, I've never liked big weddings. In fact, I was fine with just a simple, you know, just of the peace civil ceremony. That's what we did. That was in December 2021. Now, getting married was a bad idea. I will say, I think it really fast-tracked the demise of this relationship, which was a good thing. I think he figured that while he hooked me, we were married, now he could really do whatever I wanted. He could engage in this inadequate behavior, not contribute at all, manipulate me, and I would still stick around. So that was December 2021. In March 2022, he got his first DUI. So I paid for an attorney, and got that taken care of. So in May 2022, 2 months later, he got his second DUI and he totaled my car, which was paid off. So of course I had to go through the insurance. Our insurance dropped us because two DUIs in 2 months. I had to run around, get other auto insurance. I had to run around and buy a new car. Now I had a $500 monthly loan payment that I didn't have before. So adding more to my financial plate, to my bills. Now that happened on Mother's Day, May 2022, his second DUI, that happened on Mother's Day. The next day, now he was in jail, right? I called the attorney again. The next day I picked up my totaled car and his cell phone was in it. And I checked his cell phone and he had been having an affair, which started like 2 or 3 months after we got married. I'm like, this is crazy. This is crazy. I have never been as angry as I was that day. So I called the woman. I called her. And long story short, she said, yeah, we met at a bar. Shocker. Met at a bar at night. He was not wearing a wedding ring. He pretended to be single. He did not say he was with a woman, was with anybody, right? And they saw each other for, you know, a month or two, and she ended it, and she was terribly sorry. She had no idea. And I said, well, hey, it's not your fault. Like, it makes no sense for me to be angry at her, right? I was livid at him. And this is crazy, Brandon, but, like, if I had found that out before I had paid the attorney, I would have let him rot in jail. But I had already signed a contract to represent him for the second DUI. So his attorney got him bailed out of jail and I picked him up and I just let loose. I said, you are an asshole, like, you did this, I know you did this, blah, 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 blah. You know, and he's, and he just sat there because he had nothing to say, right? And still, you know, I told him, yeah, there was a, it was kind of a crazy few days. But I told him, you know, you sleep on the couch until we figure this out. Of course, he didn't do that. He refused to do that again because he refused to, you know, respect my boundaries. Now, stupidly, I stayed in the marriage a little bit longer, but I told him, that's it. You have taken advantage of me enough. You have engaged in enough inadequate behavior. We're going to couples therapy and you're going to do everything I tell you to do or you're out of here. He's like, okay. Assuming you want to be in this relationship. I told him, if you don't want to be in this relationship, grow a pair of balls and just leave. But of course he wasn't going to leave because he had it made. He had everything paid for and he could live like a single person. Now that year, so we were technically together another year, more or less. That year, I insisted we go to couples therapy. We did. He did go with me for a bit. And I really held him accountable for everything. And he did not like that. I said, you're going to do this, this, this. You're going to read this book. You're going to come to therapy. You're going to do this. He did not like being held accountable. So that emotional abuse really escalated. And the sleep deprivation really escalated. It was already pretty bad, but it escalated. I mean, like, he would sleep deprivation. I mean, like, he would poke me to wake me up at night, you know. He would come home and stumble around. He would listen to, watch YouTube videos next to me. One time I told him, please wear headphones if you're watching, looking at your phone. I'm trying to sleep. He tried to put in headphones. It didn't work. He threw the headphones on the wall. Of course, that caused an adrenaline spike. Then I couldn't sleep. So things like that, like he would do things like that, pick fights right before bed. I had an adrenaline spike. I couldn't sleep. That happened all the time, all the time. So we went to therapy. I held him accountable. Of course, he got fired shortly after that for showing up late to work again. Then he was unemployed for like a year. I kept telling him, you got to get a job, got to get a job. I kept harping on that. He didn't like that. He had all kinds of excuses why this job won't work and this job won't work and why I can't find a job and blah, blah, blah. All kinds of excuses. And I kept harping on that. A couple therapists kept harping on that. So we need to branch out and find more work. And then the couples therapist said, well, if you're home, then you can do more of the household management. So the couples therapist, John thought he could weaponize couples therapy. A lot of abusers do, right? That's why couples therapy a lot of the times doesn't work in this type of relationship. But the therapist was on to him. And when he didn't get the validation he wanted from the therapist, when he realized he could not weaponize the therapist, he got angry, and then eventually he stopped going to therapy, right? So at this same time, interestingly, I started EMDR treatment because I'm a high anxiety person. I started EMDR treatment to treat some of my childhood issues that we talked about earlier. And I did a few months of that. And interestingly, at the end of that treatment, I don't know how to explain it, but I kind of woke up. It was like waking up from a fog. I got the detachment necessary to realize this relationship is ridiculously toxic. And I always knew that somehow, right? I just need to get out of it. I need to figure out a way to get out of it. I need to figure out a way to get him out of my house. My house that I alone own and pay for. I just need to get him out. You know, a bunch of stuff happened around that time. There was an episode where he didn't like something and he threw a plate against the kitchen floor, right? Broke something. And I told him, that happens again, you're out of here. Like, I'm going to call the cops if you break something again. Like, that's not acceptable. And he would, again, this is an example of his manipulation. He would say, well, that wasn't as bad as the time my father did X, right? And I said, I don't care. You don't get to decide what I will or will not tolerate. I will not tolerate you breaking things. So if you're going to do it again, leave, right? For example, he didn't like that. He didn't like that I was really being firm with my boundaries and my rules of what I would and would not tolerate. So I stopped my EMDR treatment. I was like, man, I need to leave. I need to figure out a way to leave. I share with my sister, hey, I'm planning to leave this relationship. She's like, okay, let me know what I can do to help. She's my best friend and biggest supporter. She's like, oh, well, let me know what I can do to help. I said, I'll let you know, but I need to, you know, talk to my attorney, get things organized, things like this. What I was hoping was, he was talking about taking a trip to Texas. And I thought, because at this time he was unemployed, and I thought, well, that's great. He could go to Texas and then I could just call him and say, hey, we're done. Don't come back here. Change the locks. We're done. Right. I wanted to be nice and clean, but you know, I think he intuited that I was about to pull the plug because his behavior got really bad. So one of the ways he escalated was with the sleep deprivation, I had said. So sometimes if my son was at his father's house that week, I would sleep in his room. So John would not wake me up when he got home late or stumbled around or whatever. Well, John didn't like that. Sometimes John would, you know, come in the room and bother me. And this was something we had brought up in couples therapy. And the therapist said, you need to be able to sleep. So if she goes to the other room to sleep, you need to let her sleep. So I had a big, I'm an author, and I had a big author event in October 2023, something around that time. September 2023. And the night before the author event, I slept in the other room. Well, John, by this time, he had gotten a job and he had come home late from the job, saw that I wasn't in the marital bed, and just got angry. And I woke up to him throwing things around in the other room, not in my room where I was, in the other room, throwing things around, saying, fuck you, all this stuff, slamming doors, all these things. And I laid in bed terrified with my phone thinking, do I call the police? I'm terrified, but he's not doing anything to me. And if the police come and talk to him and leave me alone with him, I'll be even more terrified. Like, what can I do? And I just stood there, sat there, or lay down there paralyzed with my phone, heart racing, completely unable to sleep. Of course, the next day I have to do this author event and I was absolutely exhausted. And afterward, I was absolutely exhausted. Just, I was like, I almost like breaking down from exhaustion. I mean, that's just an example of the escalation of the behavior, just really trying to keep me controlled and compliant. So the next day I called the local domestic violence hotline. I called my attorney and they both said, look, if you had called the police, it's unclear if they would have arrested him because he didn't do anything to you, right? This is the kind of the problem. And the abusers know this. They know this. They know about the gray area. They know what they can get away with. It's extremely insidious. So it was not enough for protective order, for example. But I had to get him out of the house. And I had told him already to leave. I had told him, by this time I had told him, we're done, you need to go out, you need to leave. And he said the same thing as he always said, I don't have any place to go. I don't have any place to go. I don't have any place to go. And my attorney told me, you cannot force him out of the house because you're married and he has a marital right to the house. Not a property right, because his name is not on the title, but he has a marital right to be in the house. You cannot just kick him out legally, right? I had told John by this time, we're done. And interestingly, the impetus for me having that conversation with him was in late 2023, he came with me to a different author event and they were actually hiring at that restaurant and he fell into a job because he knew somebody who worked there. Of course, my heart sunk when he got a job because I thought, man, I was this close to like sending him to Texas on a trip and then we could do a clean break. So he got this job. So I sat down with him and I told him twice. I told him, you're going to give me the paychecks from this job and I'm going to use them to pay off my credit cards. Do you agree? Yes, I agree. Great. Long story short, he hid his first paycheck from me and used it to buy home brewing supplies to quote unquote make money. It's another thing I attributed to his ADHD. He was always coming up with crazy ways to make money that never materialize. And so I found out he hid the check from me and I was livid. I told him, we agreed. I sat you down twice, looked you in the eye, and we agreed you were going to use this money to pay off my credit card bills that I've been running up because you've been unemployed. And then his response was, can I get some breathing room? I need new work shirts. Well, he didn't use that money to buy new work shirts. He used it for home brewing supplies and to go out drinking. I was absolutely livid. And in fact, I told him I told him, I'm stupid. I'm stupid for staying in this relationship. So a couple of days later, I gathered up my courage and I said, we're done. We're done. I cannot financially afford to support you anymore. Move out. And his response was very calmly. He said, I pushed you too far. That was his response. And he was right. He did push me too far. That was like the straw that broke the camel's back. So I told him to leave. He wouldn't leave. And I said, well, until you figure out where you're staying, you sleep on the couch. I do not want to be physical. Do not try to be physical with me. We are broken up. Of course, he did not respect any of that. I was trying to fend him off. He refused to sleep anywhere else other than the marital bed. You know, it was just try to, you know, cuddle with me, all those things. And my attorney told me, in my state, you have to be separated for 12 months before filing for divorce. And I thought, I am not enduring manipulation for 12 months. It's not happening. I'm not enduring him for 12 months, like doing an in-house separation. So I convinced him. I told him, I need a break from you. I'm going to pay for you to stay in the Airbnb for a couple weeks. I packed his bags for him. I woke him up at 3 p.m. and told him, we got to go to the Airbnb. I drove him to the Airbnb. It was Thanksgiving week, 2023. Well, not quite, but almost Thanksgiving week, 2023. And he was kind of complaining about, oh, Thanksgiving. And I just said nothing. I said, I dropped him off there. I went back to the house. I had the locksmith come over. I changed the locks. In my absolute anxiety-induced fog, I forgot that we have a Ring doorbell camera. And he saw the locks being changed through the Ring doorbell camera, came over to the house, took an Uber using my credit card to come over to the house and confront me. By that time, the locks were already changed. Banging on the door. And I said, no, man, we're done. I told you, we're done. You can't do this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, you know, he has no money. Go ahead and try to sue me, dude. Litigate if you want. But I didn't say that, but I thought that. So yeah, he, and this is emblematic of how he operated. He got angry. He would switch between anger, victim. He got angry. And when that didn't work, he said, please come out here. I want to talk to you face to face. And I said, no, I'm afraid of you. He said, can I at least get my things? I said, no, I'll ship them to you. Then he got angry again and banged on the door. And I called the police. And well, by the time the police got there, he had left. But before he had left, he went to my gate and he literally ripped my wooden gate apart with his bare hands. It was crazy. So that's how it effectively ended. Of course, there was post-separation abuse. I called my attorney. My attorney said, you still do not have enough to get a protective order because he did not harm you. I thought, okay. So basically, after John calmed down, I told him I would, there's a lot of back and forth, I ended up agreeing to pay for him to rent a room somewhere else for like 4 months because he knew that legally I could not kick him out of the house. I didn't want any problems. I didn't want him to somehow cobble together a suit or be able to sue me because I did not want him back in the house. So I paid for him to rent a room for 4 months. During that time, I paid for his Ubers, his groceries, and his rent. And he told me, I will do anything to make this relationship work, anything. And I said, great. Now, I had already decided to end the relationship, but there's a weird process where you're like hand-holding the person kind of out of your life, you know? So I was trying to kind of keep the peace, but also keep my distance. I agreed to pay for his rent for 4 months. And he told me, I will do anything to make this relationship work. Let's go back to therapy. I said, no, I told you I'm done. I'm not doing any more relationship work. If you want to, and I said, if you can show me that you can be financially independent by taking over the rent payments for me, getting a job and paying to maintain yourself, show me that you can pay to maintain yourself. Right. But he didn't do that. He tried to see me. He tried to have contact with me. He tried to get me to have dinner with him. And I said, no, 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 no. And then when I was gone one weekend, he broke into my house. I still don't know how he did it. I don't know if he got a key somehow or there was a window that was unlocked. I don't know because he did not show up on my security camera. but there were signs that he had been in the house, and later he admitted to being in the house. And my attorney told me, in my state, in Virginia, you can get a protective order if there are two counts of stalking. So if he stalks you again, you can get a protective order. So he did show up after I told him to stay away from the house multiple times. He did show up again at the house late at night, drunk. I called the police, he was arrested, and I was able to get a protective order. So that was kind of the end of that segment. So I was able to keep him away from me. Now, he still tried to kind of get to me. He threatened self-harm multiple times. The police called me a few times to find out his location because he had threatened self-harm. He threatened self-harm on my birthday. So the police were calling me on my birthday. So again, that's, you know, very consistent with this abusive behavior, right? Is ruining special days for the victim, things like that. So yeah, so that's how it ended. Eventually I, you know, got the divorce and don't have any contact with him, but that is essentially what happened. But I will say, I have never been as terrified as I was in the months after I kicked him out of the house. It is terrifying because the abuser loses everything. And it's like, you have no idea what they will do. It's very unpredictable. So I mean, I understand why people have a hard time leaving, because sometimes the thought of that is so terrifying. You can't deal with that. It was bad.
Did you have like nightmares as well? And were you ruminating about everything for a while?
I did ruminate a lot. Yeah, I did ruminate a lot. Yeah.
And at a certain point, when did things start to feel better for you? And, you know, you lost a lot of things, you know, internally during that relationship. So, you know, how did you start to like reclaim who you were and get yourself back to being who you were once again? And then also, did you have conversations with your son about everything as like a debrief and how things affected him? And I guess, how is your relationship different with him now in the aftermath as well?
Right. So my son and I have always been close. So we've always been close. That will kind of be the biggest regret for me, is how it affected him. And how, you know, I think it affected him clearly directly, but it also affected him seeing how hard it was on me. Like he made comments that he could tell when I was suffering, even though I tried to put on a happy face for him, like he could tell. So that was, you know, heartbreaking to hear that kids are seeing their parents suffer. That's got to be destabilizing. He and I have debriefed a lot on that. Gotten help for that. You know, we've both done family therapy, and that was helpful. So it definitely, I guess one silver lining is it really leads me to appreciate certain things and appreciate the relationship I have with my son and appreciate the things that really matter, right? That we're safe, that we're emotionally in a good place, and that we're both really resilient, right? And so definitely it leads me to appreciate those things. And but definitely in some ways brought us closer. Like I'm so grateful that that we have just the freedom to just be and be safe. Like my son got home from a trip with his dad this summer, and he came back to my house and he was in really good spirits. And he said, your house is like, he's like, this house has always been my safe space for me. Like, this is where I can be myself. That was really good. That was really like, makes my heart happy now to think about that, right? That's the place we are now. But yeah, about your question, Brandon, about like, how long did it take? Almost immediately, I felt relief at having John out of the house. It did take a while. Like my nervous system needed probably almost a year to kind of reset. There was a point where I was going to sleep at like eight at night, getting up at like 5 or 6. I was just sleeping a lot. Your nervous system is completely just wiped out. That took a while. I've been doing psychotherapy for a long time. So I did specialized trauma therapy for a while. That was very helpful to point out some of the patterns and some of the things, the dynamics. So, but it does take a while. I isolated a lot. Like, I was just home alone by myself. And it's funny because eventually when you give yourself that space, you remember who you were before all of this started. Like, oh, like you think like, oh, I have this interest. I used to do this too. And I used to have a good time. Like, I have a large social group now. We go out with my friends. And I thought recently, why didn't I do this before? Well, because I was exhausted all the time, right? And John never told me, I forbid you to do X. I forbid you to go out with your friends. He never did that. But I self-isolated because I was exhausted. That's how he kept me isolated, through the exhaustion and also feeling ashamed, right? So, that's a different way they can keep you isolated. It's not always about forbidding you from doing things. It's just about keeping you with the chaos making, keeping you so busy and exhausted. That's all you have time to do is just triage, basically like triaging your life. So.
And if you had any words of wisdom for everyone listening, what would they be?
Oh my gosh. So the first thing is, number one, don't commit too soon. If somebody is trying to hook you quickly, that's a huge indicator you should take your time. The other big thing is, if you feel any confusion about a relationship, if you are confused about what the other person thinks about you, their commitment to you, who they are, if there is any confusion about anything, do not move forward. Do not. At the very least, do not take that next like commitment step with them. Because that confusion, they keep you guessing, they keep you busy, they keep you in a brain fog. That's a way they can isolate you and get you under their control. So, you know, healthy relationships, there's healthy communication. You should not feel confused. Even if the other person is telling you they're not ready for a commitment, at least you're not confused about that, right? So that's a huge indicator. I wish somebody had told me that if you feel confused about anything, do not move forward in the relationship.
Well, Maria, I really want to thank you for being here with us today, sharing your story, you know, giving all the little tiny, you know, nuances that occurred in your relationship that are so helpful for everyone to like validate their experience. And I'm sorry you had to go through all of this and, you know, being used in such a way and abused as well, and the betrayal trauma of everything. And I'm just happy you're here to tell your story, that, you know, the rumination has lessened and that you're yourself again, or part of yourself again, at least on your way. So just a really big thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you, Brandon. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Maria, for being our guest today. And if you want to be a guest like Maria was today, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com and click on the guest form button at the top of the page. There you can read all of our instructions, and please read them all, and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form and press the submit button, and please do send it in the format that we ask for. Also at our website, we have a support group, so if you need support, join our support group by clicking on the support group button at narcissistapocalypse.com. Inside, you'll see that we have Zoom meetings every Wednesday night, Thursday afternoons, and Saturday nights. We have forum boards for you to post on to get the validation that you need from survivors just like you. It is a wonderful group of people on there, and you can make a lot of friends too. So if you need support, join our support group today. And if you need even more support, please do visit our friends at domesticshelters.org. At domesticshelters.org, they have articles and resources to help you make sense of everything that you're dealing with. And they have every phone number, email address, and web address for shelters and agencies. And no matter how big or small the town you're in, domesticshelters.org has it there. So if you need extra support, please do go to domesticshelters.org. And we have friends of the show called Shelter Movers, everyone. And Shelter Movers can be found at sheltermovers.com. And what they do is they help you move all of your stuff from your home into storage. And that can be your pets and livestock, too. So if you're trying to get out of domestic violence and courts of control and you need help leaving the home, getting all of your stuff out of the home and into storage, sheltermovers.com can help you do all of that. And they are only available in Canada and is a donor-supported charitable organization. So if you need help from them or just want to donate to them, go to sheltermovers.com. And that is it for today's survivor story, for today's episode. So for myself and Maria, we hope you have a good night.